we are afraid to of the truth in the sense that we are afraid to admit that we do not know. That's the truth. And from that point on, then we will build knowledge blocks. But you've got to admit that first truth, which is ignorance.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me.
This is Andromeda 21, a series of conversations, rap sessions, with speakers from the 1971 Afro-American Cultural Lecture Series held on the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign campus. The purpose of these programs is to inform and inspire, to spread the realization that black is beautiful. The title of this program refers to the Ethiopian princess Andromeda, who, like us, was in chains, became free, and later took her place among the stars.
I wish you could know what it means to be me. Then you'd see and agree that every man should be free.
For a citizen who performed exceptionally good work for the state, the Romans gave him the label Pater Patriae, father of the country. And if such a label were given to a black person in Illinois, you would have to go to my guest today, David Addison, who is the father of blackness for this university. David created many areas of blackness which are flourishing somewhat today, and he's back to give us a talk on the silent majority, or confessions of a former student dissenter. David, what is the difference? How would you compare and contrast a black college student and the non-college hard-working people in the ghetto?
Well, I think we have to begin by saying that at 7:30 every morning in America and every black community, the latter group of people have to get up and go to work in the morning. And as a college student sits around in his dormitory room, and he decides whether or not he's going to class. He decides whether or not he's going to study or not. He decides whether he's going to the quad, or whether he's going to the union, or whether he's going to a lecture, or whether he's going to a rally. And that's the basic difference.
So the one has a decision, the other doesn't.
Exactly. The former person has a responsibility of preparing for his family, surviving, and in a lot of cases, sending money off to the latter group who's on the campus.
How would you, if we take the college students in isolation, now how would you characterize the typical black college student?
Well, at one point I would say there was no typical black college student. I would have probably taken a position some time ago that there were several kinds of black college students. There was perhaps the activist and the non-activist, and then the guy who was involved with another part of the student movement, you know, the white student movement. But I would now say that there's probably just a black student on the campuses of America who's completely confused or lazy. And I may be confused and lazy. Confused about what the issues are today, and I think that's good. I mean, that's understandable since white students are confused and that these are confusing times. But I think that we have copped out for the most part because we have not asserted ourselves to determine where we should go from here. We can do that at least.
You said that many of our students are on a trip which can lead to frustration, psychoses, and suicide. Could you explain that?
Well, I meant a lot of things by that. Black students are basically influenced by the institution, the University of Illinois or any other institution like this. And that means a lot of things. It means that he comes there basically as a naive, and when I say naive, I don't mean in a traditional sense of the word, but just someone who is not exposed to this kind of sophisticated technocratic structure. And so he comes here and he absorbs everything. And when he absorbs everything, he absorbs, you know, the old Greco-Roman Empire culture, which he's got to absorb in proper perspective, but he doesn't do it. He consumes that. And at the same time, he tries to consume what's called the Afro-American politic, you know, which is in direct conflict with that. Then at the same time, he tries to consume Pan-Africanism, and then he tries to consume, the Mideast culture, and he tries to consume Bach and Beethoven in the Kranich Center. And at the same time, he talks about the Afro and the Dashiki and all these other things. And I think notwithstanding the tremendous superhuman qualities which we've manifested and demonstrated to have in the last 400 years, you just can't go on, you know, consuming all these things without contemplating self-destruction.
So you're saying, in a sense, that we're really heading in the wrong direction. For example, academically, you indicated it's better to know American history than Bantu history. Could you elaborate on that for me?
Yeah, I made that point last night because, as you probably remember, I opposed the establishment of African studies here, or black studies here, and I did that for two reasons, one of which I didn't elaborate on last night, and that is the fact that I don't believe that American institutions are acting in good faith, or will act in good faith in the establishment of any kind of ethnic studies program that does not support the Christian ethic, or excuse me, the Protestant ethic. And of course, black studies or African studies is about basically a humanistic approach to life. And that is diametrically opposed to the ethic of this country, which is a rugged individualism. It doesn't have the collective spirit which the African lifestyle has. That's a basic reason I oppose it. But then I oppose, again, the emphasis on that kind of study because, as a practical matter, we don't know what's happening in this country. We don't know what this country has done for 400 years, even though we tell people that we do. We really don't. No.
And is a great deal of this still going on, the masquerade, we can call it, a masquerade of being experts on the ghetto problem and not really knowing too much about it?
I think it's a form of insecurity, which we have to acknowledge. And I fully realize that people listening to this will not want to hear this. But, you know, we have to acknowledge that we have certain insecurities. And when I say we, I'm talking about black people in this present discussion and white people in general. But as to the issue of our rejection of pursuit of studies, you know, we need so terribly, it's usually because we don't want to face the fact that, you know, we have to deal with that. We have to deal with American history before we can talk about, you know, comparing it to African studies.
You said we're afraid of the truth. Is this one aspect of that fear?
Well, what I mean by fearing the truth is, I mean that we are afraid of the truth in the sense that we are afraid to admit that we do not know. That's the truth. And from that point on, then we will build knowledge blocks. But you've got to admit that first truth, which is ignorance.
Do you have any formula for helping young black leaders to acknowledge this fact?
Well, I think one of the things to do, and again, you know, we all have some part of the answer. And when I say we, I'm talking about the entire group of people in this country who are oppressed. We all have part of the answer because we've had to survive here, and in doing so, we've developed certain solutions. But one of the things that I think the black intellectual has to do, the student, he's got to begin to understand what people are saying at home. And he's got to understand that what they're saying represents what is real. The university environment is a very unreal environment. Most of the ideas that are developed here and any place else like this are okay if you have established certain power bases in the world. Then you can go ahead and perpetuate theory. And you can perpetuate all sorts of myths. And you can develop all sorts of secondary cultural experiences. But black people, we have to establish certain basic things. And we have to establish, first of all, a sense of commonality in the community or in the neighborhoods. And in order to do that, you've got to understand what people are saying, what the real people are saying.
This is what hit me hard in your lecture. You remind me of an incident that happens over and over every day, I believe. On the one hand, many of our students will pose as experts on blackness in this white environment, and on the other hand, they're really kind of standoffish when they get back to the ghetto, wearing, as you phrased it so beautifully, their university smile. Now, is that as you said, they don't have much communication with the real black people in the ghetto. Is that an accurate summary of your remarks?
Yeah, that's accurate. I began to realize that when I would go home, and in retrospect, I see some of the things that I would do. I grew up in New York, and I would go home with my university attitude, and I would stand around and assess everything and assess the people's daily lives and impute all sorts of profundities to it that just didn't exist. You know, people going to work.
Whereas at the same time, your dad worked 30 years as a janitor.
Right.
And that kept you alive.
And it kept me alive, and I would confront him. You know, what do you think of the issue?
And how does he react to guys who would confront him today?
He would tell me that he has done his, he's paid his dues, he has survived, and that if we create certain problems for his, for the remainder of his life, which is short, he will destroy us. Notwithstanding all of the knowledge that we're supposed to have, we don't know what we're doing.
I think one of the great signs of masculinity and affirmation is the ability to see the beauty in our parents. Now, my dad took freight off of boxcars for 40 years and was late one day in 40 years.
Mm.
Now, I can't negate that. That's a man, you know.
That's right. You can't.
See? And that's the kind of people I think we should strive to identify with. But I guess I'm laughing a bit because your topic was the Confessions, and I immediately thought of Rousseau and St. Augustine before him, Confessions of a Former Student of Sinner. You had a lot of these attitudes before. What do you attribute your metamorphosis to, if I can use that?
Well, actually, I didn't really have the attitudes. I didn't have most of the attitudes that I've described when I was on this campus. And that's why it was very difficult for me to work as a, you know, and student, you know, in the movement on this campus, because my positions, my ideas were usually in conflict with the people I was involved with. And as a result, it would appear when I would take a position that it was a position that was not completely crystallized, because I was trying to work out a compromise between what I knew was real, which is that we were wrong in a lot of cases, and at the same time, I wanted to make sure that the attitudes that were expressed on the other side would reach some fruition, and which is a very difficult thing to do.
We've been pursuing the wrong problems. What are the real problems that we should be dealing with, Dave?
Well, let me say this before I answer that. A lot of the things we did pursue were valid. You know, the idea of increasing the number of black students and idea of increasing number of faculty, creating more jobs for people in the black community on this campus. Those are very, very basic and real things to deal with. But then we started tripping out. We started tripping out when we started talking about, African studies, and I've said that three times. But then we tripped out on some other things. We started getting involved in certain power bases on this campus. We got involved in committees on this campus that, you know, as a practical matter, we shouldn't get involved in. You know, we shouldn't get involved in any kind of university function which is not going to affect change for the majority of people. I think if we get involved in a committee structure or any issue on the campus which will only benefit the minority of black people, I'm talking about the intelligentsia again, it's an invalid thing for us to do. It's invalid so long as we have not eradicated all of the ills, or at least dealt with all of the ills that affect the majority of black people. And so we err in a lot of respects. And it's, again, I don't think it's uncommon in this historical development. I just think, and my point, as I said last night, is only to confess that, and to make sure black students begin to reach the point of confession before they leave the campus. I had to wait, and they don't have to wait, because this is a time when there's nobody, you know, there's no hell being raised on campus. So now come out and confess. You know, assess now before you go home, before you run out there and find out you can't get a job because you have labored under certain illusions. And then when you get out there, you find out that, you know, those are not saleable ideas. And in America, you got to have something to sell. And you cannot sell illusions. You cannot sell some of the ideals that we have preached around here.
And I guess you have to stop saying things like engineering are irrelevant, is that right?
That's right. I made a point last night. This is a technological society, and we've got to become technocrats.
Some of the real problems you mentioned were unemployment, housing, survival, underemployment, and dope.
Yeah, I'm glad you got me back on that point. Those are the problems. You know, those are the real problems in America. And when those are the real problems in America, they are the only problems in the black community. As I said last night, in three of the urban areas of the country, one out of every four black persons has the opportunity or will become the victim of a felony within the next 2 weeks. That felony will be perpetrated in 99% of the cases by another black person. Our mothers cannot walk down the streets unless they hide their pocketbooks in shopping bags or don't carry pocketbooks or have two people walking with them or unless they walk in the daytime in a safe community. And we have none. That's a real problem.
Whereas the opposite, you said, was white women can walk down the street by themselves. Is that right?
White women can walk down the street by themselves in their neighborhoods, and the shocking thing is that white people can walk down the street by themselves in our neighborhoods. We are the victims of our crimes.
Wow. So how should college students help to deal with these problems?
Well, first of all, I think that there's a tremendous, a prevailing view amongst black intellectuals, and that is that it's very hip to act out, you know, that when they see a brother who is a junkie or acting out, they will rationalize it and justify it. When they see someone having their pocketbook ripped off or someone who says that they've been robbed, they will give an excuse for the actions of the perpetrator. When they know that their mothers can't walk the streets of their communities, they will give an excuse that, well, the community has been the victim of a lot of things. Well, that's all a cop-out.
You said we made gangsters heroes, and
exactly.
Perhaps this is a change. Could you
exactly.
Explain that for me?
The Black Peystone Nation in Chicago is a good example of that. I spent 3 years out here in the Midwest, and oftentimes when I would go to Chicago or talk with people from Chicago, the biggest issue facing them, facing Chicago in the last 5 years, has been the continuous acts of violence perpetrated by a young group of people called the Black Peystone Nation. Very responsible leaders in this country, in Chicago particularly, Jesse Jackson for one, and a number of others, have called these constructive youth groups. Well, those are not constructive youth groups when black people who pay mortgages each month as homeowners are forced to pay those youth groups $10 a month, when black merchants are...
What's the percentage of black homeowners, David, who have to do this?
It's well over... It's well over 70%. It's well over 70%. Those are not youth groups. They are worse than the mafia. They are worse than Hitler. They are worse than anybody on any group of people who can wipe out a nation.
And again, their clientele is all black. Their victims are all black. Is
exactly,
that right?
Exactly. And I honestly welcome a challenge of any of them, you know, to deal with this question, you know, in public or in private. You know, a gangster is a gangster is a gangster. I don't care what color he is. If he threatens my life, if he threatens the life of my parents, if he requires that I, as a black student, and this is in the case of a lot of black students down here at Illinois, at Urbana, that I, as a black student, can't go home in the summer. I have to stay down here and go to summer school because I'm afraid of the gangs in Chicago. He is a problem. He's a problem that has to be dealt with.
Yeah. So in spite of the fact that ego tripping has been the norm, that we've been searching in the wrong direction, there is one man who has had a consistent view for over 30 years, Mr. Elijah Muhammad.
Mm.
What do you think is his significance for black people today?
Well, let me answer that by saying this, that when Malcolm X was alive, very few black people appreciated him. When Malcolm X was killed, people started saying he was killed for various reasons. But one thing came out of his role here before he died, and that is he conveyed to the man on the street the question of Elijah Muhammad. He at least let us know that the man exists. People in Chicago should know better than anybody else. You know, he has built an institution. He has managed to provide a sense of security within this nation for hundreds of thousands of black people, a sense of dignity and a sense of power. And of course, the Muslims require an investment. And that investment it means that you've got to be disciplined. You've got to be willing to give up some of your partying. You've got to be willing to, you have to be willing to give up that partying. You've got to be willing to go out there and sell the newspapers. You've got to be prepared to raise your family. You've got to be prepared to go to work. You've got to be prepared to commit yourself to the institution. There's nothing wrong with those things. In fact, those are basically things that people have to do in order to go from one level to another in this society. And all they're saying is that we demand it of everybody. And we are saying, or at least I think we say, and I admit to myself also, since I haven't committed myself to the Muslims, we have taken the positions that that is too heavy a commitment. And if we can say, if we have concluded that it's too heavy a commitment just to be disciplined and just to build a nation, everything else we've been saying the last 5 years, you know, the Pan-African rhetoric and all the other rhetoric, is nonsense.
The way you phrased it was so beautiful. You said he's the only person who has created a community where people can come together psychologically, where women are unmolested and unsolicited.
That's right.
You indicated that some very, very important results which will occur if we don't do what we're supposed to do. You mentioned roughly four of them, David, and the most important result would be we'll have no communication with the real black people, namely, say, with our parents as well as among others.
Well, I began to list the reasons, the results of a failure of us to realistically assess what we're doing or what we've not done. And, of course, I have a great sense of family. And the reason I do is because I erred when I was 17 years old and I stormed out my house one day and I didn't come back for 3 years because I viewed what was said to me in context of very, very basic domestic family argument as being irrelevant. You know the
that's the word, man.
And so I packed up and left. And then as I went away and then I came back and then I worked my way through college, and then each time I'd go home and I would, you know, on a vacation, note vacation or semester break, I would go home, sit around the house, and I would always notice one continuous fundamental thing, and that is that my parents were going to work as long as I can remember. As long as I can remember. And the only people who talked about retirement was middle-class America. And so I would say to myself, well, you know, maybe, you know, I have to respect them. And I have to respect all people like them. I don't care what their political and their philosophical views are. And then I began to realize that as I pursued my education, that my education was taking me away from respect for basic people, because educational institutions and education in America teaches you that you must lead and that you cannot be told anything by anyone who does not speak with the same vocabulary that you use. And hence you go home, and even though you have come from the womb of a mother who's probably worked 40 years and who's probably guided the lifestyle of the person who's your professor, you look at your mother and your parents, who don't have the kind of expertise you do, with a certain kind of disrespect. In fact, you're ashamed of them.
Wow.
In fact, sometimes you don't tell people that your parents are janitors. You say, my father's a doctor. I mean, how many doctors do we have in this country?
And this is part of that truth, I think, we need to admit to ourselves and others.
Sure. So, you know, and if we keep going in this direction, we'll continually close the gap. You know, the parents are, widen the gap. We'll have fewer people talking to each other. You know, that idea of saying people saying, hey, brother, is going to be a thing of the past, because we'll just march forward into what is called the American dream, and we'll ride down the street 10 years from now and say, well, I wonder why those Negroes can't get themselves together.
Which is the very thing we started out condemning when this movement began.
Exactly.
What would be the final message or word you could give to black college students who are sincere and want to change, David?
Well, one of the things I'd like to say, I began to say it last night when one of the students said to me at the Cultural Center after the formal talk, he said at the Cultural Center, well, David, I wanted to ask you a question, but I didn't want you to want to ask this question when we were at the formal lecture. And I said, well, why not? He said, well, I didn't want to confront you. Well, you see, if he didn't confront me while I was on the stage, he missed an opportunity to bring into question something I said and to raise it in the minds of a lot of people who are sitting there who may also felt they didn't want to confront me there. My message to black students in that respect, and black people in general, is that you've got to confront people. You know, if you believe that certain people who are leading you or allegedly leading you are wrong and who really don't do not really represent what you're about, confront them. Confront them. Bring them right on out, any place, at any time. Because if you don't do that, you give them legitimacy.
The amazing conclusion I make about all you've said is that the truth will make you free.
That's right.
My guest today has been the father of blackness on the campus of the University of Illinois, Mr. David Addison, who is presently an attorney, a special consultant for the Mayor's Criminal Justice Coordinating Council in New York City, a 1970 graduate of the College of Law at this University of Illinois in Urbana, and former president of the Black Students Association at the University of Illinois.
This has been Andromeda 21, another in the series of conversations with speakers from the 1971 Afro-American Culture Lecture Series held on the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign campus. Your host for this series is Hank Parker, instructor in the Department of Classics at the University of Illinois.
All the love that's in my heart. Remove all the bars that keep us apart.
Andromeda 21 was produced and directed by Louise Geislers for WILL, the radio service of the University of Illinois in Urbana.
Like I'm long.